officer in the form of a threat to fight. That's a natural understanding of those words. In fact, it would be hard to understand them in any other way. And given the fact that there was no other Illinois or no other provision of the Indiana intimidation statute that fit the defendant's admissions even at all, it's perfectly reasonable to conclude that the Indiana court viewed the statement in precisely the same way and viewed the defendant as having made a sufficient admission to satisfy the requirements of subsection C1, and that is a threat to unlawfully unlawfully harm or injure another person. Now, with respect to the question that was raised,
if you're going to duke it out, the other person might really harm you.
Well, fisticuffs are going to involve physical harm. Perhaps both people would be physically harmed. I don't think that rules out the possibility that the officer would. And the defendant admitted to having intentionally placed the officer in fear of injury. Actually, the terminology was fear of harm. And so, taken together with the rest of the criminal information and the statute itself, it's really unreasonable to understand the defendant's statements in any other way. It's true that the defendant minced words during the plea colloquy. The government takes that position as well. But that mincing of words was insufficient, inadequate to remove the defendant's admissions from being admissions relating to physical harm. And I would say, Your Honor, that defendants rarely use statutory language when they provide a factual basis for their guilty plea. It's going to be very common that we have to look at a defendant's statements and understand them as best we can in determining not only...
Let's do a variation on this. Let's assume let's duke it out is covered by C1 because it doesn't seem to be covered by any other subsection. That leaves Judge Sykes's question from the last oral argument, which is, are we sure that C1 is limited to physical injury as opposed to financial, emotional, or some other kinds of injury? Now, I know your brief, footnote 8 in your brief, collects a bunch of Indiana cases putting physical injury under C1. But are there Indiana cases saying that C1 does not cover other kinds of injury?
I'm aware of no such cases, but I'm also aware of no case that says C1 covers anything different. So not quite what you're asking, but mm-hmm. toward that end. And then in terms of the question of there's two questions. One is, how do we know C1 means physical force? And that is addressed in footnote 8 of our brief.
Well, actually, the more precise question is, how do we know that C1 means only physical
right.
force?
And in that case, again, with respect to the fact that there are no Indiana cases that interpret it any other way is one way that you can know that. And the fact that, as Judge Easterbrook states or asked about, the fact that the other subsections seem to deal with different kinds of physical force or different kinds of harm that might naturally be included
right.
in the general
so
term injury.
C6 deals with defamation, and C7 deals with financial harm. But as a matter of Indiana law, would that lead the Indiana courts to say the same kind of harm can't be in two subsections at once?
If a
prosecutor charged defamation under C1, would that be dismissed under Indiana law? There's some, obviously not Indiana cases construing C1, but some other statute that would tell us, as a matter of Indiana interpretive rules, what happens?
I don't know the answer to that question. I did not see any in my research, but I did not look for that. I mean, perhaps I should have, but I did not look for that particular type of case. What I looked for were cases interpreting C1.
And well, one way to get at this is to ask whether if the threat encompassed both the threat of physical harm and the threat of financial harm, whether the prosecutor in Indiana under Indiana law could charge two crimes, two offenses, or only one.
That's right. And I don't know of cases that deal with the jury instructions regarding this statute, and I don't know what the answer to your question on unanimity. Do not know the answer to those. I'd be glad to try and search that out and provide a supplemental memo to the court. But what I would say is that with the exception of the defamation subsection that Judge Easterbrook raises, most of the subsections in the statute tend to deal with facts that are pretty distinct. Yes, you can envision some slight overlaps between the different subsections, but in general,
well,
they deal with pretty...
there's complete overlap between sub 1 and sub 3 if sub 1 mm-hmm. only means a threat of physical injury, because that would always be a crime, right?
Well,
so if we interpret or presume that the Indiana courts interpret sub C1 to mean only physical harm, then that swallows sub C3.
Well, that would also require the court to interpret sub 3 in a more narrow way, because sub 3 seems to be kind of an omnibus provision. And in that case, that would be a case where potentially both subsections would apply, as you say. I mean, in fact, they probably would always apply. But a general threat to commit a crime, I mean, the reason for putting that in there, I think it's very unlikely that that was included to try and encompass and basically repeat sub 1, you know, in those contexts. It seems to me there's no purpose in that. And it would be better to interpret sub 3 as attempting to deal with things other than what's covered in the other subsections. But these are the questions you're asking, the very specific questions about Indiana law, are not questions that were addressed by either party in the briefs. And the government, you know, would be glad to try and address these as best we could in a supplemental filing if the court thinks that that would be helpful.
It's pretty clear that Judge Anderson's rationale here was wrong. Even if his bottom line was right in favor of the defendant, his rationale was wrong.
That's the government's firm feeling. I mean, basically what Judge Anderson did was determine that, I mean, in a way what he did was disagree with the Supreme Court's restrictions in Shepard and say that, you know, I mean, ultimately, and it's included in our brief, the quote from the judge where he says that, you know, I just don't see how an 18-month suspended sentence can justify making this man an armed career criminal. Well, the lightness of the sentence is not one of the considerations under Shepard, no matter how you cut it. And his rationale was plainly wrong. The government contends that his decision was also wrong. And again, we offered to file a supplemental brief if the court would find that helpful. For these reasons, Your Honor, we do ask that the court reverse the judge's the sentence imposed by the district court in this case and remand the case for resentencing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Blagan?
Yes. In a brief defense of Judge Anderson, some of the things that he was saying that may appear to not be directly related to whether the person was convicted of a violent felony was he was also dealing at that level with the otherwise prong that the government was pushing in the district court, which says that if it's a certain kind of offense like burglary, arson, extortion, or otherwise involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, it can also qualify. Begay has, a Supreme Court opinion, Begay has kind of ruled that out, but at the time that wasn't so clear. So some of Judge Anderson's comments are related to that. Others, I might have to agree with the government, are outside of what Shepard allows a court to look at, but this is a de novo review, so I don't know that that matters much. To address something that Judge Easterbrook raised in the prior argument about the Shepard case, I think the statute in Wisconsin is similar. It doesn't have as many prongs as the Indiana statute, as many variety of ways. But the key difference is that in Shepard, the defendant conceded that what he had said to a security guard was, if you don't get out of my way, I'll shoot you. And that's what the
Sperber. You're thinking Sperber.
You're right. I'm sorry. Sperber.
We do. Shepard is also important. That's the Supreme Court case. Ours is Sperber.
Sperber. That's the Wisconsin statute. That's similar, but the distinction is that
I know Sperber said that, but of course the reason I initially asked about Sperber is that the state statute seems to look very much like this statute, and the Wisconsin statute has got a thing that looks like a parallel to sub 1 in the Indiana statute, sub C1, which we understood in Sperberg to deal with physical harm rather than emotional or financial or some other kind of harm. And the first thing we need to do is get the statute right, and then we can see whether the defendant has conceded violating it. Is there some difference between the language in C1 of 35, 45, endless string of numbers, the Indiana statute, and the equivalent language in the Wisconsin statute that would lead to an interpretive difference?
Well, I think they're similar. The prong one from the Wisconsin statute is a threat to injure another and a threat to accuse another falsely of a crime. So there's slight differences. So I think they're very similar, but I think the Sperberg analysis is fine to use here, which is in a statute which has multiple ways of violating it, the government has the burden of necessarily showing that it was a violent felony or a threat of physical force. And there was no threat of physical force here. What the government in two arguments now has kind of ignored is that in response to the Indiana judge's questions of, did you threaten to physically injure anyone, Mr. Ellis twice said no. Actually, it was the prosecutor's questions. He twice said no, and then he goes on to say what he did say. And of course, we only have Mr. Ellis's view.
I don't understand what a fist fight is, except an event in which each participant tries to injure the other by punching him.
Right, but it's mutual. And in this case, it was a...
But there's nothing in the Indiana statute that says unlawfully injure the person threatened, paren, unless that person threatens to injure you too.
But what it does say is that there are other ways to do it. Committing a crime, for example. Disorderly conduct is fighting in Indiana. Fighting is not necessarily... You don't get charged and convicted of battery for having a mutual fight with someone on the street. You get charged with disorderly conduct because the both of you are fighting. What Mr. Ellis did not say was, take off your gun and your badge and I'm going to knock your lights out. What he said was, it appeared to me that the officer wanted to fight me. He wanted to have a non-police related fight with me. And I told him, that's okay with me if you take off your gun and your badge because I'm not a fool. I'm not going to fight a police officer and I'm not going to fight an armed man.
You know, this sounds to me like a collateral challenge to the intimidation conviction and the sufficiency of the plea colloquy to support the judge's acceptance of the plea to this offense.
Well, we
don't do that in federal sentencing proceedings.
I understand that, and I frankly know how to do that if I can and if I have time, which there isn't time here. But it's not, because then every challenge to is there sufficient proof that he violated a certain section would be considered a collateral challenge. We have what the judge said, and we have what the defendant said. And in none of those did he say that he was threatening physical force. He said, if you want to do something to me, we can have a fight as long as you're not under the office of a police officer. But what I think shows that this is so much of a mess that the government can't possibly meet its burden is that he was charged with this threat in retaliation for an arrest. All of these discussions were had before the arrest. The prosecutor asks him about a statement that he says supposedly is on a tape, which we can presume is a tape recording in the officer's squad car. Ellis denies saying what the prosecutor thought was on the tape. And we don't even have this. We could have him on a tape in a squad car saying, because you arrested me, I'm going to get credit cards in your name and ruin your finances. We don't know that that's not what happened. We don't know that he didn't say, I'm going to say that you are the...
It's not what happened in the plea colloquy, however.
It's not, but I see that I'm...
Shepard says that's where we go. Right?
Yes.
We go to the charging paper and the plea colloquy and stop.
Right, but the charging paper and the plea colloquy don't match up. And the plea colloquy does not admit to threatening physical violence.
Well, I understand your frustration because it's also vague. He was uncounseled. And because of this, whatever this is, he is a career criminal.
Judge Anderson said he was not, so at the moment, at least in one court, he isn't. But my last point, if I can, I would suggest that the defendant shouldn't wear the 15-year jacket for the failures of the prosecutor and the court to specify which type of offense he committed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Blagan, we thank you, too, for agreeing to represent Mr. Ellis.